Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in Review. But first, we present There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a programme presented and produced by Jill Bevilacqua, which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
Jesus took Peter, John and James and went up onto a mountain to pray. While he was praying, his face changed in appearance and his clothes became dazzlingly white. Suddenly two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah. They appeared in glory and spoke of his passage which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. Peter and those with him had fallen into a deep sleep, but awakening they saw his glory, and likewise saw the two men who were standing with him. When these were leaving, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, how good it is for us to be here. Let us set up three booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not really know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and the disciples grew fearful as the others entered it. Then from the cloud came a voice which said, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." When the voice fell silent, Jesus was there alone. The disciples kept quiet, telling nothing of what they had seen at that time to anyone.
The event of the Transfiguration often tends to be limited in our perception of it to the dramatic element, the whiteness, the appearance of the two Old Testament prophets, the cloud and the shadow, the fear of the apostles, the sudden voice, the return to normality. And it is dramatic, but there is so much meaning behind the drama we may never truly penetrate it. Certain aspects, however, have been pointed out to us by scholars and preachers. Only a week earlier, Jesus had spoken of his passion and death. And in our Gospel today, we heard that Moses and Elijah spoke of his passage, which he was about to fulfil in Jerusalem. Luke was writing in Greek, and the word he used was exodos, which can mean death, but can suggest the idea that it is a passage, an exodus, towards glory, of which the Transfiguration is an anticipation. The other important point is stressed by a Cistercian monk who comments that the true lesson of Mount Tabor is not the one people often draw from it. In the mystery of the Transfiguration, the essential thing for the apostles was not so much having glimpsed Jesus in glory, but having received this command from the very lips of the Father, "This is my Son, my beloved. Listen to him." And now to that mountain. Several important moments in our Lord's life take place on a mountain or hill. The Sermon on the Mount, the temptations in the desert, and his last appearance before ascending into heaven. As these mountains are not named, a modern scholar suggests two from the Old Testament: Mount Sinai, where Moses received the tables of the law, and Mount Sion, mountain of the temple of Yahweh, which all the nations will stream to. Although both Matthew and Mark write of a high mountain, the traditional site of the Transfiguration, Mount Tabor, is less than 2,000 feet high. Some have preferred Mount Hermon, over four times as high and always covered with snow. But Tabor was considered sacred even in the Old Testament, and it's impressive enough. Luke says simply, "He took with him Peter and John and James and went up to the mountain to pray." Something he did often. Matthew and Mark add another detail. Jesus led them to a place where they could be alone, apart in the old version. And as he prayed, writes Luke, the aspect of his face was changed. "Became as dazzling as the sun," writes Matthew, "his clothes as radiant as light." White as the light, in the Jerusalem Bible version. Nothing could add beauty to light, wrote Christopher Wren, the great architect of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Wren was making a report on the medieval fabric of Salisbury Cathedral and had special words of praise for its windows, which let in the maximum light. This belief led Wren to avoid the use of stained glass in his later buildings. The whiteness of our Lord's clothes, explain scholars, signify that he belongs to the heavenly world. Angels appear dressed in white. When the women go to his tomb to embalm Jesus, they find a young man in a white robe. And white are the robes of the martyrs figured in the Apocalypse, the people who have been through the great persecution and have washed their robes white again in the blood of the Lamb. In our prayers for the souls of the faithful departed, light is one of the three things we ask God to give them. Eternal rest give to them, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them. May they rest in peace. The poets, too, are in agreement that the next world is one of light, wrote Henry Vaughan in the 17th century.
I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time, in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled.
In another poem, Friends Departed, the light they inhabit even reaches into his memory of them.
They are all gone into the world of light, and I alone sit lingering here. Their very memory is fair and bright, and my sad thoughts doth clear. It glows and glitters in my cloudy breast like stars upon some gloomy grove, or those faint beams in which this hill is dressed after the sun's remove. I see them walking in an air of glory whose light doth trample on my days, which are at best but dull and hoary, mere glimmering and decays.
A contemporary of Vaughan's, but his senior by some 30 years, Robert Herrick wrote of the White Island, or the Place of the Blessed.
In this world, the Isle of Dreams, while we sit by sorrow's streams, tears and terrors are our themes reciting. But when once from hence we fly, more and more approaching nigh unto young eternity uniting, in that whiter island, where things are ever more sincere, candor here and lustre there delighting.
Gardeners, too, have written of whiteness and have even created white gardens. The most famous of these is in Kent, at Sissinghurst, and was planted by the poet-gardener Vita Sackville-West. When she was making it, she wrote in her diary,
I cannot help hoping that the great ghostly barn owl will sweep silently across a pale garden next summer in the twilight. The pale garden that I am now planting under the first flakes of snow. I dare to say of white, that neutral tint usually regarded as an absence of colour, that it is every bit as receptive of changing light as the blues and reds and purples. I love colour and rejoice in it, but white is lovely to me forever. The ice-green shades that it can take on in certain lights, by twilight or by moonlight, make a dream of the garden, an unreal vision.
Up on Mount Tabor, the apostles were in no condition to be analysing the quality of light or whiteness which dazzled them. Luke writes that they were heavy with sleep, though they clearly saw our Lord in his glory and Moses and Elijah with him. But there's a delightful homely touch in Mark's account. Mark, we're given to understand, was Peter's amanuensis, And as Peter was married, though we never hear of his wife, we know he lived with his mother-in-law. Was it not perhaps to impress upon her the brilliance of Christ's clothing that he told her and made Mark record that his clothes became dazzlingly white, whiter than any earthly bleacher could make them? I like to think it may have been so. When Moses and Elijah were on the point of leaving Jesus, we read that Peter expressed his joy and made his suggestion, though both Luke and Mark comment he did not know what he was saying. With your permission, I will erect 3 booths here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents. Let us make 3 tabernacles. The 3 words for the same thing call up different images. Booths, for me, would probably be stalls in a big field for a fair of some kind. And then there are telephone booths. Tabernacles are the precious receptacles of the Blessed Sacrament. But tents, now there's a word for you. Tents are Boy Scouts and the outdoor life. Family holidays when the children were small and we could only afford to camp. Arctic explorers, mountaineers, and St. Paul. Yes, I can see St. Paul in Corinth with his sailmaker's needle, making and mending tents with his friends Aquila and Prisca, tent makers like himself. But for the Jewish people, the tent, the booth, the tabernacle, is the symbol of one of their 3 main feasts, the Feast of Tabernacles, commemorating the way their forefathers lived in booths or tents in the wilderness, and celebrating the final gathering in of the harvest and the vintage. The feast, which falls in autumn, lasts for 7 days. We read in Leviticus what God prescribed to Moses.
You shall take boughs of leafy trees and willows from the riverbank. You are to live in shelters, so that your descendants may know that I made the sons of Israel live in shelters when I brought them out of the land of Egypt.
St. John, in his Gospel, mentions the feast and that Jesus went up to Jerusalem for it, but in secret. A chronicler tells how the people would build booths of green branches in the squares and on the terraces, and
as soon as darkness fell, on the evening of the first day of the feast, the priests lit great lamps hanging from on high, and immediately the crowd lit innumerable other lights of every kind.
This feast reminds me of the famous Chapter of Mats held by St. Francis of Assisi when 5,000 friars gathered on the plain surrounding Santa Maria degli Angeli, writes Omer Engelbert.
Divided into silent groups of 60, 100 or 300 men, whose sole occupation was prayer, charitably rendering service to each other, or conversing of spiritual things, a group so disciplined that it could have been taken for an army encamped.
And this was what Cardinal Ugolino exclaimed when he came to visit them. We read in The Little Flowers of St. Francis that they were so quiet and meek that there was no sound or noise. It was summertime, and so
each group had made tents covered on top and round about with rushes and mats. Accordingly, this chapter was called the Chapter of Rushes or Mats. They slept on the bare ground or on straw, and their pillows were stones or pieces of wood.
On this occasion, St. Dominic was also present and was shocked when Francis told his friars not to worry about their bodily nourishment, as Christ would provide.
He expected disaster to befall these thousands of hungry and heedless men, but the Lord showed that feeding his poor belonged to him. For a long procession of donkeys and mules was soon seen arriving, laden with bread and wine, beans, cheese, and all sorts of victuals.
Dominic had to admit the intervention of Providence, and we read,
After apologizing for having taxed Francis with blundering, he promised to observe evangelical poverty hitherto himself and to make its practice mandatory on his sons.
And to conclude these reflections on the Transfiguration, here are some lines by the Franciscan Capuchin friar Mark Elvins on the Eastern Christian understanding of the event.
In the Christian East, Christ is understood to have continuously radiated the glory of God. But because of human sin, people saw only a man. At the Transfiguration, however, it was the sight of Peter, James, and John that was transfigured. The icons show the light radiating from Christ and touching the eyes of Peter, James, and John, who thus see Christ as he truly is, with the whole of creation reflecting his glory.
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for bringing us yet another There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. She brings us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, when I left you last week, you were talking about a learning curve for everybody in
exactly.
the Vatican.
It's been an amazing week, and we're still on that curve.
Because of the resignation.
Of the Pope is what we're talking about, because not having... The last Pope to freely resign was actually Celestine V in 1294. Gregory XII resigned, but he was forced to resign. That was like 600 years ago. So the last free resignation, as Benedict XVI has given his, was 719 years ago. So a long, long time. The Vatican is studying documents. They're studying John Paul's 1996 Apostolic Constitution, Universi Dominici Gregis. And it's very, very interesting because there's going to be a press briefing on that document at the Holy See Press Office. I've reread it twice since Benedict announced his resignation on February 11th. There actually is one place, two consecutive paragraphs, where the Pope says that these dispositions that I have written down, will write down in this document, are not to be changed, altered, et cetera, et cetera. Then in the very next paragraph, he says something to the effect that, if, however, doubts arise in the hearts and minds of the cardinals as they go into conclave, does seem to open a door a bit, just a crack, to a possible change. Now, I am not a canon lawyer, so I will not write in stone what I'm saying, but my question about those two paragraphs, one seemingly written in stone, the other opening a door a bit, that will undoubtedly come up at the press conference. So next week we'll probably know all of this better. And the reason this document is so important is because it does set the election time. Paragraph 77, the Pope says all of the preceding things that he wrote are valid even if the Pope resigns. The document is basically predicated on the death of a Pope. So, a death of a pope, you have a funeral, which must be held between the fourth and sixth day after he has died. You've got novendiales. You have novendiales. You have 9 days of mourning masses presided over by very specific people in the Roman Curia. Well, we don't have that now. And so that's why the cardinals are looking at, to first of all, see if they have the right to make a change in this document. It's a papal document. Can only the Pope make a change? Theory now is that there will indeed be a motu proprio. Will it come within hours of this show, within days of this show? We simply don't know that. The premises are there for possibly beginning a conclave before that 15 to 20 day period after a sede vacante. And again, like you said at the very beginning, this is all part of the learning curve.
And it's reflected by the fact that the director of the Holy See Press Office has briefings every day.
Yes.
And they last a long time, and journalists ask all kinds of questions, no?
Well, it's very, very interesting because a lot of the questions, yes, they're technical. And as part of the learning curve, I haven't heard this asked for a day or two, but what will the Pope wear? But he won't be Pope anymore. We do have to stress that because I have heard journalists on television, the people who are not in Rome covering this, but somebody in studio in Lord knows what country, and they're asking their guests in Rome, well, now, what does the church do when there are two popes? Folks, there are not going to be two popes. You will have a former retired pope, whatever title he's going to have, that will be Benedict the 16th. You'll have one reigning pope that will be chosen in the March conclave.
Difficult concept for people to...
Well, sure, for all of us, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that we're going to sit in this very studio next week and we're not going to have a pope. It's just something a little difficult to wrap our minds and perhaps even our hearts around when you think of it. And we don't see him every day, but, you know, a Sunday will come and there will be no Angelus. A typical Wednesday audience will come. There will be no audience because there will be no Pope to preside at it.
Because, of course, the Pope at 5 o'clock on
the 28th
will leave Rome by helicopter for what's his normally called his summer residence in Castel Gandolfo.
Exactly. And, you know, with Benedict, it's a residence that he loves. All the popes do very, very much. It's much more family-like.
He's used it more than most popes, I think.
Yes, because in the summer, especially the last, two or three summers now, he would go, instead of going to northern Italy, do some place in the mountains and so forth, he would go straight to Castel Gandolfo and spend, you know, his 3 months there. Last summer, 3 months except for his 3 days on his Middle East trip to Lebanon. But what's wonderful is the TV coverage of this will start at about 4:45 the afternoon of the 28th, and the Pope will say goodbye in the courtyard of San Damaso. And then he will be brought by car to the heliport in Vatican City, where he will again be greeted. This will all be on television. He will arrive. It's not a long trip at all by plane. He will arrive in Castel Gandolfo.
By helicopter.
By helicopter, yes, sorry. And the director of the papal villas at Castel Gandolfo has this week been a very generous and very intelligent, knowledgeable host in receiving the international media, cameraman, journal, whatever your job is if you're in the media. And the tour lasted about 3.5-4 hours. So you get to see a few rooms in the Apostolic Palace, then you walk through these immensely beautiful gardens, which are never open to the public. But he said that what they're expecting, the Pope will go out on the balcony. The Apostolic Palace has a balcony a hallway with two balconies off of it. One leads into the smaller inner courtyard. The other balcony leads out onto the main square of this very small, charming town called Castel Gandolfo. And Saverio Petrillo, the villa director, said, and he's been around, he's amazing, he's been around since Pius the 12th, has to be the longest serving Vatican employee. But he said they're expecting many, many thousands of people to be in the square and all the adjacent little streets and everything else. Because they talk about, the people of Castel Gandolfo talk about the Pope as their Pope. And they've always respected his privacy and been very, very helpful in trying to, you know, protect him and kind of be like gendarmes. So,
getting to the Pope himself, of course, the Pope's still in office, as we know. Joan, this has been a quiet week because he's been on spiritual exercises,
right,
which have been led by Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, who is the president of the Pontifical Council for Culture. On Sunday, he kept to his Angelus, so
he
we're in a packed St. Peter's Square.
Well, as a matter of fact, the first estimates, to be honest, were something like 50,000-60,000, and then that was revised upwards to about at least 100,000 by police and so forth. And we were both in the square. I just walked around, talked to people, you know, asked them why they were here, how they found out about the Pope's resignation. A great number did say television, but a very large number did say it was the social media, how they found out about his resignation on the 11th. But it was in many, many ways a festive occasion. There were huge huge banners from organizations, Communion and Liberation, very close to the Holy Father, and to that organization. The wonderful banners, the parishes, families. I can't remember when I last saw so many children in the square. And one little girl, like she was about 7 years old, and she started to answer a question as her parents were answering my question. And I said, oh, honey, I'd love your input. I said, you're very young. It's very important to me what you say. She said, he's such a good man, the Pope. And I just thought that was so cute. I mean, a seven-year-old, you know, who wouldn't know doctrine or anything like that. But it was a wonderful day. Benedict is so humble, though. When he becomes the center of attention like this, as he did at the Ash Wednesday Mass, at the end of Mass, the long applause and so forth, he's almost uncomfortable. He thanked the people, because he did speak after the Angelus, which was dedicated to the gospel about the temptations of Christ, the temptation in the wilderness, which is proclaimed every year on the first Sunday of Lent.
Today we contemplate Christ in the desert, fasting, praying, and being tempted. As we begin our Lenten journey, we join him and we ask him to give us strength to fight our weaknesses. Let me also thank you for the prayers and support you have shown me in these days. May God bless all of you.
So the Pope did talk about temptations at great length, and he said that the tempter is cunning. He does not directly impel us towards evil, but rather towards a false good, making us believe the true realities are power and everything that satisfies our primary needs. In this way, God becomes secondary. He's reduced to means. In short, he becomes unreal. He no longer counts. He disappears. So ultimately, said Pope Benedict, in temptation, faith is at stake because God is at stake. So huge applause, and then he did greet the faithful in a number of different languages, as is his custom. And I found it very interesting. His comments will be brief and slightly different, usually, in the different languages. In Spanish, he did ask the people to pray for him and to pray for the next pope. So very, you know, people love to read something into a statement like that. Is he suggesting a geographic area that his successor should come from? So these are exciting times. They're historic. They're sad. Those of us who certainly work here see the Pope all the time. But there's millions of faithful all over the world who are mourning this man, you know, as he's leaving us, and in his own words, he said he's going to be nascosto, hidden away in the monastery, which we did get to see in our tour of Vatican City.
The sense of shock, isn't there?
Shock, yes, exactly. Shock. I said to one television outlet that interviewed me, I said I was stunned but not surprised. I said those of us who cover him in Rome see him very, very often. Vatican Radio, you all know you can hear in a person's voice if they're well or not, or if it's their typical, you can hear better than a lot of us who look at a person's face. So you could see a physical decline. So that's why I always said I was stunned at the announcement, but not surprised that it would happen.
Thank you very much, Joan.
Well, you're welcome. God bless.
And you were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, while we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, we will be back again at this same time next weekend. So be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.